Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as we've been hearing in the news, Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz defeated former Justice Dan Kelly in yesterday's election for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. We'll find out what that outcome means and look at some other election results. First, one out of every 20 U.S. adults now own at least one AR-15-style rifle. According to a poll of gun owners from the Washington Post and Ipsos, there are roughly 20 million in circulation. According to the gun industry, AR-15s are the best-selling rifle in the United States, and they account for about 1 in 4 guns made in the U.S. today. AR-15s have also been used in 10 of the 17 deadliest mass shootings since 2012. The Washington Post spent the past 7 months interviewing more than 200 people with connections to AR-15s, including industry lobbyists, police officers, gun owners, gun control advocates, trauma surgeons, and shooting victims. Last week, the newspaper published a series of stories that begins with the statement the AR-15 is more than a weapon. Two of the reporters who worked on that series join us now, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you own an AR-15? What do you want people to know about that firearm and why you chose to purchase it? How can we reduce gun violence in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert Klemko covers criminal justice for the Washington Post. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Alex Horton is a national security reporter at the Washington Post. Alex, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me too.
Alex, can you give us a brief history of the Armalite Rifle 15?
Sure. Yeah. So the company Armalite responded to a government contract request to build a new kind of rifle. You know, the military was looking to replace, the sort of older, heavier, big caliber weapons that they used in World War II. So they wanted to take a look at some updated and new concepts. So the company Armalite, which was already making a survival rifle for Air Force pilots, produced the AR-10, which shot like a 7.62 caliber round, which is, you know, about the same size as an AK-47. And the Pentagon said, yeah, we like it. It's lighter. It's better. We want to go even smaller than that. So they produced, they called the AR-15 in a kind of new caliber called Remington 223. So the Pentagon was sort of divisive on this, depending on who you asked. Some of them wanted to stick with the big rounds used in weapons like the M14 and M1. Others were proponents of shooting smaller rounds at higher velocity. So this weapon was used in prototype form in Vietnam as the AR-15 until it became the M16 later on when the Army designated that in 1964. That was also the same year that Colt, which acquired the rights from Armalite, began producing it for the civilian market under the name, again, AR-15. So that's how I sort of got its start from, you know, military prototype to sucked into the Pentagon as the standard duty rifle, the M16.
And Alex, so when it comes to the civilian market, you and your colleagues write in one piece that the gun industry didn't necessarily think of this as having a lot of appeal to the civilian market. In fact, they seem to look askance at this idea of selling this kind of firearm in semi-automatic versions to the civilian public. What changed?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the AR-15 being so unusual, but you got to put yourself in the frame of mind of a buyer in 1964. You're used to surplus M1 carbines from World War II. You're used to your dad's hunting rifle that's, you know, wood stock, bolt action, you know, nice looking walnut finish. In your mind's eye, you think of a rifle of something that is completely different than the AR-15, which was made out of aluminum, plastic, and other metals. It shot a round that's really small, which was very different from, traditional hunting ammunition. It was all black. It was very different when it hit the market, the civilian semi-automatic version in 1964. So they had to get over a lot of skepticism. I think the Vietnam War helped it with its image, with its cousin, the M16. But for a long time, the AR-15 was sort of seen as something maybe you take, you know, along your hunting rifle. Maybe you just plink targets or in some ads that described it, plink varmints on your property. It didn't take until after the so-called assault rifle ban in 2004 sunsetted for marketers to really get their hands around, how do we sell this thing again? So they increased their appeal any number of ways, you know, showing it as a tool that the police use, showing it as close to what you can get that soldiers use, like the M4. So certainly Iraq and Afghanistan helped show what a rifle like the AR-15 could be used in the real world. And here it is, you can buy the next best thing that the military uses. So it was a product of all those circumstances and, you know, this very deliberate marketing push to reinvent and restylize the weapon in a post 9/11 post ban world.
And Robert, now we have a lot of different makes and models in the AR-15 family. What is it that makes them effective, that makes them deadly?
Well, I think Alex can tell you a little bit more about this as an ex-soldier. You know, I think that the weapon has, as he mentioned, a higher velocity. It's very effective in terms of being able to reload it. I spoke with a police trainer who described it as the Mustang of guns. And what he was referring to was the ability to modify the weapon. So, you know, whether it's citizens or cops purchase this weapon, there's often all sorts of accessories that you can tack on to it. Much like a Mustang, you know, you can make a lot of different modifications to it with a lot of different products from different companies. So there's this separate but, you know, related industry around the AR-15 in terms of accessorizing it, whether it's a rail-mounted light or various grips. There's 100 different ways that you can sort of toy with this gun, which I think is appealing to consumers.
And Alex, do you have thoughts on, again, the functionality of the weapon and why people might find it appealing?
Yeah, Rob raises a lot of interesting and great points about it. It's something that you could modify and accessorize to your liking. Another reason it's appealing for consumers and, as we know, you know, some mass shooters is it's very easy to use compared to other rifles. It's a low barrier to understanding. It's lighter than most rifles, coming in at about, you know, typically around 6 or 7 pounds. The ammunition is light, so the recoil is slight compared to a weapon like an AK-47 or an SKS, for example. So, you know, AR-15s don't have a monopoly on high velocity. Other rifles have similar velocity, within a few hundred feet per second. What makes it different, I think, is more of its sort of saturation in the market. There's just a lot more of them than any other kind of semi-automatic rifle that have similar, if not identical, capabilities. The magazine that you can use for that also plays a part. Again, not unique to this weapon, but, you know, in most states you can have a 30-round magazine, without any penalty. So, you know, if you wanted to go to the range and shoot 100 rounds pretty quickly, you can do that. If you want to use that for nefarious reasons, you can do that in the exact same way. It's not uniquely dangerous compared to other rifles or even have, you know, a slate of unique characteristics compared to other rifles. I think it's the ubiquity, it's the ease of use, and your ability to modify in different ways that's appealing for people who want to have it recreationally or have it for more sinister means.
Talking to Alex Horton and Robert Klemko from the Washington Post about a big series on AR-15 rifles. Robert, I want to turn to a piece you wrote now. You looked specifically at police departments focused in on Colorado. And there's kind of a double-sided thing. Police officers fear the ubiquity that Alex just mentioned of these weapons in many hands. And they also feel like they're in an arms race where they have to arm up with these kind of weapons. Can you talk about what you learned there?
Yeah, we wanted to go to Colorado Springs specifically because they've had a number of recent mass shootings involving AR-15s where officers responded, which is a rare thing. I mean, you know, you look back at Columbine and a number of the other mass shooting events that we've had, it's very rare that the police are able to respond quickly enough to actually fire on that person. And in a lot of cases, that person has killed themselves either just before or as the police arrive. But the Springs have had a number of these incidents where officers have actually been fired upon. I spoke with an officer who interrupted a 2015 mass shooting on Halloween in Colorado Springs, who ended up not having time to get his AR-15 out of his car and wound up hiding behind his patrol cruiser while Noah Harpum, after killing three other people, shot up his car. So I spoke to some of these officers, and what they talked about, really, I didn't expect. Some of the older guys talked about how they had, when they had entered the department, 25, 30 years ago, they were handed a revolver, and they, most of the time, they never even pulled it out. I mean, guys went their whole careers without ever using it. Now they feel like the violence and the times where they're forced to use their weapons has escalated. The type of weaponry has escalated because of the sorts of weapons that they're seeing out on the street. So now the AR-15 is the predominant duty rifle for the Colorado Springs Police Department and most departments across the country. And then on the other side of that spectrum, there's a lot of pressure for police to learn, really advanced de-escalation skills, to be able to deal with mental health crises in ways that maybe they weren't asked to decades ago. So you have police being pulled in all these different directions. And this one officer I spoke to said, I don't think people are prepared or equipped to be police today as well as maybe we were when I joined.
Talking to Robert Klemko and Alex Horton with The Washington Post, part of a series of stories about the AR-15 in America. They're with us today to help explain our complicated relationship with this class of firearms. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests about this series, about what they learned about AR-15 rifles in the United States? Do you own one yourself? Could you talk us through your thinking on purchasing this type of firearm versus something else? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Alex Horton and Robert Klemko from The Washington Post. Last week, the newspaper published a series of stories reporting on the AR-15's rise in popularity and the gun's role in American life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on questions about this very popular class of rifles. If you've fired one yourself, if you own one yourself, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, I've heard Marjorie Taylor Greene and others say we need more good guys with guns. So I mean, what they want? They want these duels on Main Street or something? I just doesn't make sense. Why not just go for fewer guns instead of figuring we need more duels?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Now, first of all, Robert, that reminds me of a moment in your piece. One of the police officers you talked to, I think of the confrontation you were just talking about. Had to make a decision. He could shoot at this person who was armed and dangerous. On the other side of that person was a Wendy's restaurant. Police are finding themselves in these decision-making moments. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, one of the sort of practical difficulties when you really think about this argument that you need more good guys with guns is that it makes it difficult for law enforcement to sort of sort out the good guys from the bad guys when they arrive onto a scene. Aurora had a recent shooting, I believe it was last year in Aurora, Colorado, just up the street from Colorado Springs, where a good guy with a gun stopped a bad guy with a gun, and then he himself was shot, the good guy, by an arriving police officer. Because, if you're a cop, you get a call about shots fired in a public place, you show up and somebody has a gun. It's pretty safe to assume that's the guy. But if you actually apply this idea that we need more good guys with guns, it's a little bit more complicated than I think Marjorie Taylor Greene ever expands on.
Thanks for the call. Kay joins us now in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for your reporters doing this job. I've been studying legal issues involved in the military and weapons due to my Civil War research for years. I've also been a New York City Auxiliary Police officer and been close to gun violence myself. Two things. A physician just last week on this radio said that there's no way to stop the damage or that I can stitch together the body damage from a bullet from an AR-15 because it explodes the organs. So Anne Ella Carroll, my Lincoln legalist, wrote, the military is the only preventive force and a country cannot make war on its own people. And the Geneva Accords say special protection should be afforded children. So, for instance, in Maryland in 1861,
I'm going to jump in. We don't have a lot of time left. Thanks for the call. Alex, your colleagues, I don't know if you were on this piece. Some of your colleagues looked into Kay's first point there, the damage that a high-velocity weapon like an AR-15 can do. Can you share a little bit about what they looked at?
Yeah, they reviewed some autopsy reports and two real-world examples of two children who were killed in mass shootings. The shooter used an AR-15, and they looked at what it does to the body. And, you know, essentially, because the round is traveling much faster than it does in a typical handgun, about three times faster than a typical, you know, 9mm. When a bullet enters the body, it becomes unstable and it tends to turn and to yaw. So that creates a deeper wound channel than if you had been shot with something like a pistol. Again, this isn't that kind of effect, and that kind of devastation is not unique to AR-15s, but given the saturation of them, you know, that's what makes them, pretty dangerous to folks to be shot by. And you also have to remember that the ranges where this can be effective, you know, you can only shoot a pistol, you know, maybe effectively within, you know, 10, 20 yards, but, you know, you could be 100, 200 yards away from someone firing an AR-15 and receive a fatal wound. So that's what makes them a little bit more dangerous, or, you know, a lot more dangerous than pistols. But compared to other rifles, pretty similar.
Thanks for that call. Chris joins us now in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hey. So as an AR-15 owner, well, previous AR-15 owner, I did want to say a couple things, and unfortunately I missed the last few minutes of the conversation, so hopefully none of this was brought up. I think the reason why AR-15s are so popular is because of their affordability. They're cheap. They're a dime a dozen. I can buy them at the hardware store. I can buy them at a Walmart. I can buy them, well, pretty much anywhere. And I think that's why the market's become so saturated with them, because the AR-15 is merely a platform. They can have many different calibers. And I liked how the last caller talked about the damage of the wound channels. Yes, a lot of the AR-15 owners around here actually own a weapon called the AR-10, which is a larger caliber for deer hunting. Hmm. Is it necessary? No.
But Chris, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. That ubiquity we were talking about, Alex, Chris says find them everywhere and they're not too expensive. Briefly, could you touch on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's probably one of the cheapest rifles you can buy. Just, you know, some models are as cheap as, you know, $500, $600. So the entry-level models, you know, you could buy and accessorize, and, you know, maybe it's $1,000 out the door for optics and lights and all the other stuff. So that's definitely a reason why they're so popular, is you can get a good one for a few hundred bucks. You can get a great one for, you know, $1,000 or $2,000.
Chris, thanks for sharing your experience. Jeff joins us now in West Salem. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, Rob. Hi. I was just thinking, I had the thought that I remember the proliferation of all these supposedly AR rifles and stuff seemed to go back to when they were having that bank robbery. I believe it was on the West Coast in San Francisco, where the robbers had so much firepower, the police couldn't do anything about it. And I think that's kind of where it all started, in my opinion.
Jeff, I got you. And Robert, I think you reported on that California bank robbery.
Yeah, that was in 1997. It's known as the North Hollywood Shootout. It actually inspired one of the scenes, the bank robbery scene in the film Heat with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. It's a shooting that inspired a lot of police departments to start to carry the guns, because the Los Angeles Police Department officers who responded to it were so outgunned that they ended up essentially raiding local gun stores and borrowing AR-15s so that they could try to get a handle on these culprits. That certainly popularized the weapon. And then, I don't think you can ignore the effect of the media attention and, the film itself, Heat. If you think about iconic shootout scenes, I mean, that scene in Heat has to be up there. They're carrying AR-15s, both the cops and the bad guys.
Thanks a lot for that call. And we'll leave it there. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Alex.
We appreciate it.
We're talking to Alex Horton and Robert Klemko, reporters for The Washington Post. It released a series of stories last week about the AR-15 in American culture and politics and more. They joined us for a look at how the AR-15 became so prominent in the United States, how it's affecting our politics, law enforcement, public safety. You can read more of their and their colleagues' reporting at thewashingtonpost.com. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the results, trends, and implications from yesterday's statewide election, including the biggie for the state Supreme Court. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, video games are big and educational video games are becoming a more common tool. We'll talk to one of the directors of the UW-Madison Field Day Lab that designs online games to teach students about science, history, journalism, and more. Now, in an election race that set new records for fundraising and drew the nation's attention to Wisconsin, there was a decisive winner.
Our state is taking a step forward to a better and brighter future, where our rights and freedoms will be protected.
That was Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz talking last night in Milwaukee. The AP called the state Supreme Court race for her just under an hour after polls closed. A much closer race was the special election for a seat in Wisconsin's 8th Senate District, which could give Republicans in the state Senate a powerful tool. We're going to check out the results, what they mean for Wisconsin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What responses do you have to the outcomes of yesterday's elections, especially the Supreme Court one? What do you want to know? What questions do you have? How did you vote? Did it work smoothly for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Well, once again, we've been here before, Sean. Wisconsin at the center of national attention for an election. Same old, or was this even bigger than we've seen in the past?
We tell ourselves that every election is bigger than the last, you know? So, and I really do think this was a very big election because of what was at stake. Mm-hmm. I just also am realistic and know that probably in 2024, getting close to November, we'll be saying the same thing, but this was big. Yes.
We've been hearing the news about turnout in the election, setting a record for these nonpartisan races. Talk about the big turnout around the state.
Yeah, there were more than 1.8 million people who voted in the Supreme Court election. So to put that in context, if you were in Wisconsin in 2008, there was a Supreme Court election that was extremely high turnout for the time. It was a high stakes election. You know, we were saying a lot of stuff, the same stuff back then. This was after former Republican Governor Scott Walker had signed his landmark union bargaining law, Act 10. And it was kind of viewed as a referendum on Walker, David Prosser, the conservative, versus Joanne Kloppenburg, the liberal. That was 1.5 million people that voted in that race, which was at the time the Super Bowl of judicial elections, kind of. This one was 1.8 million people, so around 38% of turnout. I mean, you're getting up close to like gubernatorial level turnout there when you're talking that. It was actually 39% in this race. That's very high, and it just shows you how energized people were in this campaign, and particularly on the Protasiewicz side, which, you know, she had a lopsided victory, about 11 percentage points.
We often look at the geography of voting in Wisconsin and look at trends for how regions change and who they support over time. So far, Sean, anything striking you there?
Well, I mean, Protasiewicz won a lot of counties. I'm not saying for a Democrat, I'd say, because the Democratic vote is often so focused on the bigger urban counties. And that was definitely the case this time. She did expand her reach a little bit more. I kind of look at the last few elections that we've had in Wisconsin, the last several elections we've had in Wisconsin, in the same way. This Dane County vote machine, it just gets more and more powerful. It is a fast-growing county. I mean, the population is growing here, and the intensity of the Democratic vote is growing in Dane County. And because of that, it's having a larger and larger say in statewide elections. You're also seeing this other trend where the wow counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington, the powerful suburban Republican districts that used to counteract Dane County, are continuing a slide to the left. They are still Republican counties, but they are not the Republican counties of a decade ago, not by a long shot. I mean, if you look at Ozaukee County, north of Milwaukee County, Dan Kelly only got 52% of the vote there. It's you know, dang near blue in that county, which, you know, tell us that 10 years ago, we would have thought, no way, but here we are.
Talking to WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, looking at yesterday's election results, especially for state Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the campaign? What swayed your vote one way or another? Did you see lots and lots of ads? Were you sick of seeing lots and lots of ads in this race? What led you to vote, if you're willing to share, the way that you did? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sean, you mentioned that Prosser-Kloppenburg race, seen by many as a referendum on Governor Walker and Act 10 and things like this. What are your thoughts on the issues in this race? A lot of people, I think, around the country have looked at Wisconsin and said this is a race about abortion and abortion rights.
If you talk to Janet Protasiewicz supporters, it seems like that was the first issue they always mentioned when they were asked to frame the race. They talked about it being about abortion rights. They talked about it being about redistricting. You know, they want to get rid of the state's Republican-drawn legislative maps. And then if there was a third issue, it would be just who's in control of the court when the 2024 presidential election rolls around, because we saw in 2020, after that election, there was just a barrage of lawsuits that landed on the state Supreme Court's door. And, you know, the courts ruled 4-3 against Republicans in those lawsuits, but that is a narrow margin. And so this race by Democrats was billed as a way to ensure that when those lawsuits are filed in 2024, we don't know that they're going to be over, but that we know that there will be election lawsuits in 2024, that it's a liberal majority that hears them and not a conservative majority. And with the outcome of this race, we know that Janet Protasiewicz will be one of the seven justices who provides the final say on election lawsuits that are filed in state court.
A tough thing about talking about Supreme Court races, Sean, and I'm guessing covering them, is, you know, a lot of voters want to know what judges think of particular issues. Judges running tend to not want to say what they think about something they might have to rule on. they find subtle cues, like Protasiewicz talking about her values leading toward pro-choice, the Kelly campaign criticizing her, but sharing press releases when he got endorsed by the pro-life groups in the state for his judicial temperament, basically. I don't know. How do these candidates send their messages without saying, yeah, I'm going to vote this way on this issue when I'm on the court?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the recent Democratic victories in Wisconsin, and I say Democratic, understanding that these are nonpartisan races and they do not run with an R or a D after their name, but voters know, which candidate is supported by which party. And if you look at the 2018 Wisconsin Supreme Court race, Rebecca Dallet won. She was the Democratic favorite. She talked about her values. She criticized President Donald Trump. You look at the 2020 race, Jill Karofsky won. She talked about her values, and they were Democratic values. She talked about public schools, said she was worried about, gun safety, things like that. And then if you look at this year's race, 2023, I think Janet Protasiewicz took it up a notch. You know, she talked about her support for abortion rights. She called the Republican-drawn legislative maps rigged. Those are very strong terms. And she did qualify it each time by saying, I'm not telling you how I'm going to rule in these cases, but she was very forthcoming with her personal beliefs on those issues. And, there are voters out there who liked it a lot. They said, how am I going to know who to support in this day and age, in this hyper-partisan era, when they're not talking about what they're for? And so they were glad to hear Janet Protasiewicz say, I'm for abortion rights. But, you look back on the court like 15 years ago when liberals lost the majority, their candidate, Lewis Butler, was the opposite. He did not want to talk politics when he was running. And, you could say he paid a price for it. But I think Democrats have figured out a formula for what works in these April races. And it involves saying more where they stand on issues that appeal to Democratic voters.
We're going to talk about nonpartisan races tomorrow afternoon here on Central Time with Mordecai Lee and how they've become more partisan. Let's go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. The groveling and pitiful so-called concession speech by Daniel Kelly was just a despicable and desperate display of the kind of person that under any circumstances should be barred from seeking election to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. He really showed us what he is. Whether you support Protasiewicz or not, you know what that guy was about, and he was bad.
Tom, thanks for the call. A lot of attention to former Justice Kelly's comments at that event last night. Here's a listen, Sean.
And it brings me no joy to say this. I wish that in a circumstance like this, I would be able to concede to a worthy opponent. But I do not have a worthy opponent to which I can concede. This was the most deeply deceitful, dishonorable, despicable campaign I have ever seen run for the courts.
Sean, you and I have talked about a lot of elections over the years, a lot of hard-fought ones, some close ones. I don't think I've heard anything like this, except maybe Donald Trump to some extent, apart, but for a Wisconsin candidate, I can't think of any precedent for statements like that after an election.
I can't either for a Wisconsin candidate, and I have been kind of thinking about it. Was there anything that I've ever heard like that? And I'm pretty sure the answer is no. I mean, it's not to say that there hasn't been bad blood between candidates on election night before, but typically the response to that is the losing candidate says very little, a concession speech that says, wish it had gone the other way. Thanks for your support. Even if they don't say anything about their opponent. In this case, that was a campaign speech, but the campaign was over. So no, I've not heard something like that before. That was a snippet of it. There were more examples too. He was very critical of Judge Protasiewicz. It followed with what he had said on the campaign too. So the campaign didn't end for Dan Kelly.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, looking at results from yesterday's statewide election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll hear from more of you coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with WPR's Sean Johnson, Capital Bureau Chief, looking at results from yesterday's statewide election. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Seymour. Andrew, hi.
Hey, Rob. Hi, Sean. Thanks for taking my call. I had a quick question about the District 8 state Senate seat and the effects that that might have on impeachment trials, given that now apparently the Republicans have supermajority in the state Senate, and if that's a risk for Judge Janet to be impeached right off the bat before she even takes the seat.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Not just that, impeachment at other levels people are concerned about. Sean, what are you watching for there?
Yeah, so it's, I mean, I will say this is kind of a new issue for me. And frankly, it's a new issue for everybody because we've never in Wisconsin impeached anyone since 1853. So, you know, I don't remember that, Rob.
I wasn't there for that one, Sean.
No, we didn't do a Central Time segment on that one. But the way that impeachment works in Wisconsin is that it takes a majority vote in the assembly, and then it takes a two-thirds vote. It takes a majority vote in the assembly to impeach, and then it takes a two-thirds vote in the Senate to convict. And in the Senate, they now have two-thirds of the members are Republicans. And so, yeah, in theory, they could impeach state officers. And what does that mean? You know, that term, it means like governors, attorneys general, and judges. And just in a follow-up email with the state's Legislative Reference Bureau today, they said, yeah, it also includes justices. And so in theory, I believe, yes, the legislature could impeach justices. Now, what are lawmakers saying about that right now? What are Republican lawmakers saying about it right now? The Senate Majority Leader, Devin Lemieux, was asked today if they're going to impeach Janet Protasiewicz, and he said no. Dan Knodel, the Republican senator who won that seat, was talking about it, and he's saying, you know, I don't want to impeach any justices on the court. And so it seems like this is something that, if you take them at their word, is not going to happen in the near future. However, it is, as best as I can tell, a power that the Republican legislature now has that they didn't before they won this 8th district last night.
Thanks a lot for that call. Pat joins us now in Milwaukee. Pat, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Pat?
Well, I was listening earlier when you were talking about people voting and why they voted. And from my perspective, I've lived in Wisconsin my entire life. I don't belong formally. But I think that it's pretty clear that the citizens of Wisconsin.
You're breaking up, Pat. Our producer says you wanted to bring up gerrymandering as the issue that led you to vote the way you did. And Sean, let's talk about that now. Our political boundary lines in Wisconsin. They've made it to the state's Supreme Court and to the U.S. Supreme Court many times before. What are people looking at now with this new lineup of the Supreme Court in Wisconsin?
Well, we know that Justice-elect Janet Protasiewicz has said that the Republican Dong legislative maps are rigged and that she would like the court to take another look at those maps. And every indication is that she will get her wish. There's a 4-3 liberal majority on the court beginning August 1st when she takes office. And all it takes is somebody to file a lawsuit. And I'm not sure exactly what they'll challenge. You know, they've been some hints out there, but we'll know soon enough. And once it's in the court's hands, any number of things can happen. The court could order parties to submit new maps and then pick one, you know, much like happened in the last go-round with redistricting in 2021 when the Supreme Court took over the issue, and in 2022 when they eventually ultimately blessed the map passed by Republicans in the legislature with a new makeup of the court, you could see a similar process play out, but with different guidelines. You know, they could leave parties more open. They could tell parties, say, you know, like what they want to emphasize. And it, you could have a map that is more Democratic. I will say, like, because of the way the votes in this state are really clustered in Madison and Milwaukee, if it's a little trickier to just draw a 50-50 map, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of represent our state's politics, but certainly not impossible. And map makers are very clever people, and I imagine you'll get some very Democratic maps submitted to the court.
Thanks for that call, Pat. Art is with us now in Milwaukee. Art, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. So I'm wondering if abortion rights are reestablished in Wisconsin, and maybe it's 2 years from now, the next time there's a Supreme Court race, that issue is out of the way. I think it's maybe Justice Bradley, who leans towards the liberal side, seat is up. Can the Republicans take it back?
All right. Thanks for the call, Sean. Looking to the future there.
Yeah, that crossed my mind too. And I don't know, you know, I mean, I think that the issue is especially turbocharged right now. I mean, abortion has been a part of political campaigns for a long time, but obviously it's carrying more weight now. And I think that's an open question. If the court addresses that and, you know, we go back to kind of the reality before last summer, when there are still abortion restrictions in Wisconsin, but abortion is legal, would that kind of change the playing field? It might. I would also say, though, that this race was not just run on abortion. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on which media market you were in, you might have gotten different attack heads on Dan Kelly from the Protasiewicz campaign, you know, attacking him for being that they used the word extreme a lot. They attacked him for stuff that he wrote about in a blog a decade ago, where he was critical of Social Security. You know, not an issue that's going to come before the state Supreme Court, but an issue that makes potent television ads. So, you know, Democrats did have election success prior to the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe. So I don't think that you can chalk up the Protasiewicz win here entirely to the abortion landscape, because in 2020, Jill Karofsky won by a similar margin. And in 2018, Rebecca Dallet also won by a similar margin, though in a much lower turnout election.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more call. John is with us in Appleton. John, hi.
Hey, thank you. Sean, please confirm that Governor Walker opened the gates toward huge, massive funding of these elections. Can you please confirm that? I think it was in 2015 or 16.
John, thanks for the call. Sean, changes I know happened to campaign finance laws in Wisconsin under the Walker administration. Do you remember what we saw there, and did it impact yesterday?
It changed the way that money flows. Yes. I think that like some of the outside groups that helped fund Dan Kelly's campaign are basically operating in a similar world that they were prior to that law. You know, if they run these so-called issue ads where they're like, you know, tell so-and-so to stop being so soft on crime, they can raise their money a different way. They can keep their donors private, all that. What Walker did, and with the help of the Republican legislature, they passed a law that let political parties raise unlimited amounts of money. And so, like, the Democratic Party, Republican Party too, but the Democratic Party's gotten really good at it. They can accept big donations, $1 million donations, you name it. And then they can transfer that money, unlimited transfers, to a candidate. And so they transferred all that money to Janet Protasiewicz. And that gave her the benefit of being able to control this large pot of money and buy ads as a candidate at lower rates than these outside groups than they pay. So her money went farther. And yes, it was due to a campaign finance law passed by the Republican legislature in 2015 and signed by former Republican Governor Scott Walker.
Sean, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. He joined us for a look at yesterday's statewide election results and what it could mean for the future of the state. Follow more coverage over at WPR.org. Yesterday on the show, we talked about video games getting turned into movies or TV shows, like the new Mario Brothers movie and The Last of Us on TV. A lot of you called in to tell us about video games that you want to see in movie form. One caller mentioned Final Fantasy VII as a possible movie inspiration. I haven't played that game, but I know a lot of people really love it. I found out today from our own video game fan Trina LaSousa here at WPR that there was a Final Fantasy VII movie. It was called Final Fantasy VII Advent Children. I looked it up. It was a Japanese computer animation movie back in 2005. It was released in a dubbed English language version as well. Won some big awards in the anime world, and it picks up the action a couple years after the conclusion of the video game, so playing the game doesn't spoil the movie. Trina is a big fan of Final Fantasy VII. Her review of the movie said it had some good action and she liked it, but you gotta know the lore of the game universe for the movie to make sense. I'm still waiting for Computer Solitaire, the movie. This is Central Time.